はい。Assignment 5 due Wednesday. Assignment 4 will be returned at the end of today. Feedback. Let me give you some feedback on assignment 4, and then when you get it back, you can take a look. I'll also give you a suggestion. Overall, in general, assignment 4 was very well done. It was nice to read. It was fun to read. And what it clearly demonstrated is that most of you have a very good grasp of the concepts and can apply them to a real life situation, and that's what it's about. So keep doing that. The biggest problems were actually fairly small, but just so you'll know that other people had the same problem, perhaps you did. If people only left out one part or shortchanged one part, that part tended to be the inside of a change in relation. People talked about a change in relation without talking about the characteristics of relations, which are affect, power, and reciprocity. And the shorthand for that is still RAP. So if you have a marginal note that says, what about RAP? That's what it refers to. The second most common shortcoming was difficulty with the notion of developmental status and finding a change in developmental status. And there the most important thing to keep in mind is that when Bronfenbrenner is describing a change in developmental status, he's most interested, and I'm most interested in, developmental status as that's reflected in what you do on your own when nobody is telling you what to do. The complexity and variety of the molar activities that you engage in on your own. And most of you had that, but that was the difficulty that came up second most. And third was specificity in the hypotheses, in picking hypotheses to illustrate with the events that you were describing. In explaining the hypotheses, sometimes some of you just referred to the hypothesis without explaining what the fit was. And looking at the hypothesis and the experience you were describing, sometimes it was a little difficult to see exactly how that hypothesis fit or whether you understood how it fit. So the advice for next year when you take this course and do the same assignment occurred to me. I don't know why I'm doing this. Anyway, just think about the kind of like preaching to the choir, right? You won't be here next year. But if you wanted to do the assignment again, see if you can get specific about how the particular experience fits the particular hypothesis. Some advice about using the editorial comments and indications. Your papers were read twice. Julie read them all very carefully and noted where there were problems in the writing, problems in the thinking. So she did that very carefully. And then I read them all. And I made more notes on them and circled more things and occasionally wrote an okay. Once or twice I wrote an okay where Julie had questioned something, and when I read it, I thought it was fine. I think that was twice out of 2,732 that I checked. So, and you could probably go look at mine and say, "What are you doing? This is okay." So, anyway, they got read twice, and they got read twice. R-E-D, twice. They got readed twice. Anyway. The bold circles around things are mine, and they indicate there's a problem, but I didn't correct it or tell you what the problem was. The careful, legible writing is Julie's, and you can usually figure that out. What we would hope that you would do is not look at your score and throw it in the trash. We're big proponents of practice and improvement. So what we hope you will do with the hours and hours and hours of markings that we made on your papers is that you will actually go through them and figure out each one and figure out what the problem is and how you could correct it so that you will learn something from all of the editorial stuff that we made. I will interpret one mark that some of you may have some difficulty with. And that's that one. And it always is on top of a hypothesis or another concept that you were referring to. And it was Julie's way of marking that you had done that one because she was checking for completeness. So if you have a slash or a check on top of something, that means it's there. And that's all it means. So don't try to figure out what was wrong with it. If there's something wrong with it, it's underlined, or there's a question mark, or a circle around it, or a big X across. No, we didn't do that. Okay. If you can't figure out what is wrong with something, consult with three or four people and see if they can figure it out. And if you still can't figure it out, then consult with us, and we'll figure out why we marked it. A number of you I made a recommendation for, and that is that you get more coaching on writing. And the coaching is available through the Writing Center in Living Learning. So if I made that recommendation, it's a very serious recommendation that you go, your tuition is paying for it, so go get coaching and practice in the technical aspects of writing so that your writing will accurately reflect your thinking. It's rather discouraging sometimes when you know that you know something but can't figure out how to put it into words. And through most of your life, because you will have a college degree, people will expect you to be able to write clearly. So that's not something that happens automatically. You have to work at it. So keep working at it. And don't forget to use the resources that are here. Anything you want to add? Okay. Questions about assignment 4 or the feedback? Okay. Have fun with assignment 5. We're looking forward to reading them, aren't we? Yes, we are looking forward. They will be fun. We promise to have fun reading them. My wife promises not to get too bent out of shape if I spend another weekend reading papers for this course. She didn't promise that. I put those words in her mouth. I have no idea whether she's going to get bent out of shape or not. So we'll see. Other questions? Housekeeping questions? Content questions, reading questions. We were getting cohabited, right? Okay, so we're going to keep cohabiting. We were someplace here. When people decide that for whatever reason, it's usually financial or convenience or not having an apartment available other than the one that your significant other already has, or because they want to defy their parents or whatever other reason, or they just get tired of getting up in the middle of the night and going home, which is a real pain in the badootie, people decide that it would be much more convenient to actually share living space and call it home, and we call that cohabiting if you're not married. And people do that at all ages. Most of the illustrations that we'll think about in here or questions that you'll come up with will probably be about cohabiting at a relatively tender age. But my guess is that a number of you, in fact I know from reading your papers, that a number of you have parents who do cohabit with significant others. And some of you probably have grandparents who cohabit. They're living with somebody, they're in a presumably sexual or at least affectionate relationship, and are treating each other as the equivalent of spouses, but they're not married. And one of the reasons that happens is that the arrangements that people make in their couple relationships reflect often the characteristics of the macro system that surrounds them. And the macro system includes the legal system and the laws and the policies that govern couple relationships, marital responsibilities, and those sorts of things. And in cultures where we have seen more and more attention to individual rights, particularly for women, the motivation for marriage has declined. Because marriage has as one of its major functions the protection of, and I'm going to put protection in quotes, keeping women free from having to suffer all of the responsibilities and indignities that come along with full citizenship. So sometimes the only way you can have property in some cultures is to get married. The only way you can be safe is to be married. In Western cultures that have increasingly decreased the necessity for marriage by making it possible for women to be independent, marriage rates decline. And in places like Sweden, marriage is something that people only do if they are involved in a traditional church, or if they want to keep their parents pleased, or if they want to take the extra step of making a public commitment to each other and letting everybody know that they have made that commitment. But the majority of couples in Sweden no longer get married. And the rate of marriage doesn't increase very much when they have children. So marriage is declining in Sweden ahead of most of the others, but also in the other Scandinavian countries and in Canada and in the US. And interestingly, it's declined most in the Canadian province that has the highest religious participation and the highest percentage of Catholics. That one is puzzling the demographers. And the rate of cohabitation has increased among Catholics in Quebec, too. So the demographers are trying to figure out what is going on in the macro system in Quebec. In the United States, one of the reasons that our grandparents, your grandparents, my grandparents don't anymore, but one of the reasons your grandparents are choosing to cohabit rather than to get married is that often the policies surrounding retirement, financial support, the policies make it financially disadvantageous to marry. If two people are both receiving Social Security as individuals, for example, if they marry, they will receive Social Security as a couple, and they can choose which person's account to draw on, but they can't draw on both if they're married. So often it's quite disadvantageous, you know, talking about $1,000 a month, to marry. So our elders are choosing to cohabit guiltily, often with apologies to their children whom they criticized 20 years ago or 40 years ago for cohabiting, and now they're doing it and they're swallowing and saying, well, you should be married, but we can't afford to because it would cut our retirement income. Another reason is sometimes related to divorce, that sometimes spousal support is paid from one partner to the other only as long as the partner who's receiving income is not married. As soon as he or she moves in with or marries somebody, all spousal support stops. So people continue to receive the spousal support by not marrying. So there are lots of reasons for people to not marry, and there are lots of people who cohabit. The issues for all of them are more or less the same. They just have different keys, different tunes, different nuances. What we're doing when we cohabit is to decide to share a setting. One person may have a setting, the other person moves in. That means that there is an established microsystem in that setting, and then the partner moves in and you have to reorganize that microsystem. So you disrupt whatever's there. Some of you read Kathy, the cartoon. Kathy tackled cohabitation a couple of years ago, and I'll read this to you, that you probably can't see it. And then the couple who were cohabiting had gotten engaged, and now they're married, and it's been fun to watch them go through this. But she is moving in with him, and I unpacked my toothbrush. Look, our toothbrushes are in the same little cup, on the same little counter, in the same little bathroom. This is the romance of cohabitation. We are now together. We are now united. Our toothbrushes are in the same little cup. Who would have thought the simple act of sharing a bathroom would be such a symbol of our future together? And look, here's a little drawer for all the rest of your stuff. Okay. There's a gender difference in bathrooms. And one of the fun things about cohabiting as a heterosexual couple is that the bathroom stuff that men have tends to take up less space than the bathroom stuff that women have. There's a real gender difference here, and it's an important one, and this cartoon is picking up on that, that Kathy moves in with a truckload of bathroom crap, and he has cleared a drawer for her to put it all in, and they are about to have a space-sharing problem. Now, you do believe me that women and men have different bathroom stuff, right? Okay. Quick. How many of you have one bottle of hair product in the shower? Shampoo. How many of you have one bottle of shampoo? Two? I'm sorry, I'm losing a couple of men here. How many of you had none? Okay. You have eight. Yes, but Anu, you right, okay. Anu has, what, 18 inches of hair. Right? You need eight. And they use it. Okay, they use yours. Okay, how many of you have six or more? Yeah. Five. Four. Three. Okay. It generally holds up that men have one or none. They're often borrowing or stealing if they're sharing a bathroom. We occasionally go through and organize ours, and I always have one, and it's all I need. I can do everything from the neck up with one shampoo and conditioner. Why? Just, you know, put the shine in it, right? It's already soft, so I don't need anything like that. So I have one, and the significant other who shares the bathroom oscillates. I didn't count yesterday because I wasn't thinking about this particular lecture. But the last time she cleared out, she got it down to seven. And my spare one is in my study so I can find it. There are several things that I keep not in the bathroom as spares, so that when I run out, I can get the new one and put it. And there are three cabinets that I have not opened in several years because I'm afraid to. I don't know what's in there. I just know that none of it is mine. None of it. I have one little, you know, razor, aftershave. So we don't argue about the bathroom at all, because there's no point. It's never going to change. I will never have two hair products, and I would never, ever, 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 ever suggest that she have fewer. I would not do that. Whatever she wants. She's the queen. She can have whatever she wants. Okay. What happens when people move into this space that they've decided to share is that they now get to create a microsystem, which means they have to sort out roles. They have to sort out the relationships. And they have to sort out the activities that are going to happen in that space, and they have to create a pattern, the microsystem. They have to figure out what the daily rhythm is going to be. And we talked a little bit about sleep and awake cycles last time. They have to figure out how much they're going to keep clean and who's going to do what. What are the chores? What are the responsibilities? How do they divide those? What do they do about food? Presumably, when people cohabit, there's some element of eating that goes on. Unless you can do as some couples do, which is never cook. I have been amazed by couples who build a house and don't put a stove in it. I thought the first time I ran into that was very, very strange, that a person would have a kitchen with a small microwave and no oven and no cooking surfaces. And so I asked why, and the answer was, I don't cook. And if there's no stove, there's no expectation that I will cook. And this woman's husband was perfectly fine with that. They had a refrigerator. They had a table. They could have cold cereal in the morning. They could make toast. And other than that, she never cooked. and they ate all their meals out. I thought that was going to be unique in my experience. I now know four couples who don't have ovens or stoves in their kitchens, and they don't cook. Different strokes, I guess. But who does the cooking? Who does the eating? Who does the buying? Who does the planning? Who establishes the menu? Who is responsible for that? Who does the cleanup? Who cleans out the refrigerator? Who keeps track of the leftovers? Who makes sure that things that are purchased are actually cooked sometimes? Who makes sure that there are backup supplies? You can go through that list and expand on it. Who chooses the furnishings? How do they fit? Where do you put them? How are they arranged? Whose are they? If you're cohabiting and buy something, does one person buy it so it's yours? And then you let the other people use it, the other person? Or is it yours? You choose it together, you pay for it together, and you chop it in half when you move out. How do you deal with ownership of things that are in the cohabited space? What do you do about money? How do you deal with the finances? Who decides what has to be done in the space? And when you decide that something has to be done, who does it? Is one person more aware, take more initiative in decorating, in arranging, in cleaning, and the other person is cooperative and wonderful about it? Or do you mutually agree on what has to be done and you mutually do all of those things? All of these things have to be sorted out whenever you create a microsystem. If you go to boot camp in the military, all of that will be decided for you. So you're living with 10 other people in your platoon, or 12 or 16 or whatever it is. It's always an even number. And somebody is in charge. And you don't have to worry about those things because everybody does them and everybody has a schedule for doing them. But when you're friends and lovers and you move in together, there's nobody in charge of making all those things happen. So somebody has to figure out what the pattern is going to be. As you become a couple, one of the questions is, do you do this together, or does one person take charge of it? How do you divide the responsibilities? How do you share the finances? Who makes those decisions? And what happens with most couples is that there are many potential problems in sorting out that pattern. One of the things I mentioned on Wednesday, one of the things that is likely to happen is that people have brought with them, I don't know where it comes from, I don't know whether it's built into the X and Y chromosomes or we get it from media, but what happens for many couples is that they fall into the traditional, stereotypical gender roles, where she is in charge of what goes on inside, including food, cleaning, and he is in charge of what goes on outside and watching television. That's his job. Sports are his job. A little tongue-in-cheek, but not very much. The major complaint that cohabiting couples come up with, and one of the earliest ones, is the gradual awareness that you have, although you planned to come in to this as equal partners, you discover after a few weeks or a couple of months that in fact your expectations and your preferred activities are beginning to to divide, to separate into more traditional activities, in a traditional division of labor. It's very important, if you don't want to have that division of labor, that you establish that at the very beginning and then fight every day to maintain the equity and equality and non-traditional assignment of those chores, because if you don't do that vigilantly, people slide into the traditional. Even, in many cases, people who weren't raised that way, because they cohabit with people who were. And it's a transaction. And it's a transaction that people are sometimes not being cautious about, they're not being aware of. And then they have conflict about it, because she's beginning to resent that he eats and forgets to clean. She does all the meal planning, and he thinks it's really fun for a while to go to the grocery store, and they do this together, and it's really neat, and they start off cooking together, and this is really neat, and then the frequency with which it's a joint activity decreases, and eventually she discovers that she's the one who's doing it, and she's also the one who's cleaning, and they're both working 40 hours a week, or they're both taking 15 credits and working 10 hours a week, and why is this not equal? Why isn't he doing more? Because he weighs more than she does, and or whatever basis you think division of labor ought to be established on. There are a couple of other times when the traditional roles are likely to raise their heads again. Even if you're successful in not doing those household things traditionally, if you're successful when you cohabit, you may find yourself losing ground when you have children, if you have children. And what often happens is that when people have a child, or even when they become pregnant, they start dividing household labor traditionally again. And it's very difficult to maintain equity or equality if that's what people want to do. It takes a good deal of vigilance and practice to carry that out. I'll stop there on that one. Okay. How many of you have cohabited or are cohabiting? Yeah. We won't talk about sin. Okay. We're not going to do that. I won't ask you whether your parents approve or what your grandparents think of it or who you had to get permission from. We'll talk about that in a minute. But what kinds of problems have you run into, if any? I have a friend who claims that the easiest way for him to get a new partner is to offer to do her grocery shopping. He loves to grocery shop. It's a guy thing. Takes his list, goes through. And if he really wants to develop a partnership, he'll offer to take little kids with him. He loves grocery shopping. The molar activity for him. Take the kids. Spend an hour and a half showing kids things in the grocery store, talking about it. He says, man, you want to get a woman with young kids to fall for you. He said, offer to take her kids grocery shopping. it'll work. It seems to work for him. His current wife has three, and they're doing well. What other problems do you run into? None. Right? No problems?
Yeah, there are problems.
There are problems. You can share. It just kind of happens. Just slide into it. Yep. I love the boxes in the middle of the room. I moved in 1994, the end of the year, into the house where I am now. I was single. My son moved with me, the two of us. And I have a very large master bedroom. So the stuff that I didn't quite know what to do with, I stacked neatly, still in the boxes, at one end of the master bedroom. No problem, right? Not in my way. And you wouldn't believe how bent out of shape women got about the fact that those boxes were there. You know, what? I dated three different women, and they all questioned my sanity on the basis of the boxes. Absurd. You can question my sanity, but on the basis of boxes and bedroom. And that was the one thing Laurie, my wonderful wife, wanted gone when she moved in with me. They're gone. They went. That's how important she was. I was willing to move the boxes. That was in 1999. So why does it take 5 or 6 years to unpack boxes in the bedroom? Because you didn't need anything that was in them. So why? You never know. Other things.
I'm thinking one example, yes, for the back house, and there would be boxes of Kleenexes all over the apartment, okay? And if you shop, Kleenexes are not very expensive. You go through them, and toilet paper is really expensive. But he insisted on going to the bathroom and using like a whole roll of toilet paper for every time he had to blow his nose. And I'm putting boxes of Kleenex right in front of him. I'm like, please use the Kleenex, they're cheaper than toilet paper. And he just refused to do it. And that's also the why we broke up, I think.
Okay, men, we have a, I think we have a physics problem here. Why, if you're confronted with boxes of facial tissue and toilet paper, why would you choose the toilet paper over the facial tissue? Okay, so one is the ease of disposal, because it's right there. You're not, in fact, going to the toilet paper. You're going to where you're going to dispose of whatever it is you, and you want an economy of motion. Toilet paper, bleh, down it goes. Other explanations?
With cleanses, you don't know if they're heavy on.
That's right. Right. The physics of this is that tissue, facial tissue, unless it is Kleenex man size triple thickness, there's a reason why Kleenex came out with man size triple thickness facial tissue. It is for blowing men's noses on. That other stuff, the wimpy stuff, has several problems, and one is that it is often perfumed, and most of us can't stand the fragrances on that. So if you're going to buy facial tissue, it has to be non-scented. It should be triple thickness, and it ought to be big enough that men's hands can actually handle it, and they can put all of the whatever is coming out of their nose in one of them all at the same time. Right? So it's easy. And it's also reliable. It's there for the most part. No.
I was just going to say that maybe it doesn't have anything to do with it at all, but stubbornness. Because, like, I know the guys in my family and my boyfriend, you would say, like, anything off. And just because either that's what they're used to, or just because you say, can you do something else? They want to do what they want to do, and if you say, can you do this, they're going to use the toilet paper and just say, you know.
Or. That's what sleeves are for, right? Right. And this begins, this is a characteristic that is referred to as the failure or the refusal to be influenced by women. And if you watch 3- and 4-year-old boys and girls in the preschool, little girls are constantly trying to change little boys' behavior. And little boys have often a very strong autonomy streak. And because a little girl has suggested they do something differently, they are going to do it the other way. And what you see in the research on sex differences in preschool, and it continues, is that little girls actually listen to little boys and sometimes modify their behavior because little girls are more likely to listen and modify their behavior in response to verbal instruction anyway. And little boys don't listen to little girls and don't modify their behavior to accommodate little girls. And that tendency continues right on up until we mature at about 92. There's a reasonable literature on couples counseling and couples communication that incorporates that characteristic of men, of the male species. In various ways, and one of the ways that it gets incorporated is to suggest that one of the things that offends men is to be told what to do. Okay, we grew up with the boy code. People aren't supposed to tell us what to do, and we're supposed to ignore them and do it our way. That's the way you be a man, right? So the manlier we are, the less likely we are to take suggestions. And it creates fights, because women expect men to listen and to be reasonable and to accommodate, and men who aren't have fights picked with them eventually. What the literature suggests about couples communication is that women might do well if they make the suggestion and then leave it. Drop it. Just leave it. And what the counselors suggest is that after a while, if it's not a problem between you, if you don't make it a problem, then the guy will gradually come up with this great idea that he comes up with all by himself, which is that he's going to do it your way, and he's going to do what you asked him to do or suggested that he do a couple of days ago. He's going to do it because he's figured out that this actually might be reasonable. By suggesting it, you've drawn it to his attention, and it sits in there and it percolates, and then eventually, maybe, he'll say, I think we ought to move this over there, or maybe I ought to take my plate from the dining room out to the, now that the food's dried on it. That's a technique that works in parenting. It's a technique that works in both directions in couple relationships, of making a suggestion and then dropping it. If you're dealing with somebody who's intelligent and rational, if you make it an issue, you may get the resistance, and their stance toward it is going to harden, and they're going to be less likely to do it. If you make it as a suggestion, drop it, then the other person doesn't have any reason to resist, but will think about it, and eventually may work around to seeing it your way and doing it your way. And then you become a Ronald Reagan Republican. One of the few things that I liked about Ronald Reagan was that he had a sign on his desk which said, you can accomplish, I can only paraphrase it, you can accomplish a great deal if you don't worry about who's going to get the credit. So if you just throw the ideas out, they come back later and people take credit for them, but the thing gets done. It's okay. You don't have to be recognized for having the great idea. And you don't want to gloat. You never want to gloat that he finally caved in and did it your way. Never gloat. Or he'll never change ever again. Never gloat. Other things that you've run into in cohabiting. What else has destroyed your relationships? Right.
He's not like meticulous and neat and clean, but he likes order. And there's still, you know, boxes that have probably been the same boxes since I was in third grade that are still in those boxes in a garage, taking up one half of the garage.
Mm-hmm.
That belongs to my mom.
Yep. She's not an early childhood educator, is she?
No,
I just want to warn you that every early childhood educator has a basement, garage, and attic, and sometimes a rented storage unit full of curriculum materials. We have a bait. Early childhood educators tend to accumulate curriculum materials. A lot of them. It's okay to be a pack rat. It's okay to be a neatnik. Just keep them away from each other. Or they'll figure out eventually how they can live together and be comfortable, and they'll have something to comment about, and you know, it's just the stuff of life, differences among us. That's why you shouldn't throw things away, because you might want them someday. Men are as likely to be pack rats as women. Women are as likely to be neatniks as men. There are probably genes for it, but they're not sex related. Where it becomes a problem is when people disagree about it, whether it's the odd couple or in a cohabiting relationship. What else? Have trouble with money? cohabiting? Who pays the rent? Who pays the bills? Who makes sure the bills get paid? Who gets stuck with the phone bill? What do you do with money? One of the major conflicts that couples have, cohabiting or married, is money and how they handle it and who handles it and how they live within their income and what's available. So when people cohabit, one of the issues that they run into is that they go into it assuming that they will work things out, but not knowing each other's financial situation or the way the other person handles money very well. It's one thing to have somebody spend a lot of money on you if you're dating. It's another thing to have that person spend the rent money on you or other things rather than on the rent when you're cohabiting. Those are two very different things. So what is acceptable and maybe fun and romantic while you're dating becomes a real problem when you're cohabiting. How do you divide the expenses? When you're cohabiting, you go into that setting, you have to, or you don't have to, if you're going to avoid problems, you need to talk about money and you need to have a fair way of dividing the expenses. People have different food buying habits. Some people will look for the best bargain. Other people will go spend whatever it takes to have whatever they want at a particular moment. Some people will buy small quantities of things. Others will go to Costco and buy huge quantities because it's more efficient if you can plan long range to do that, if you have storage space for them. One of my favorite retirement stories was a couple who were friends of my first mother-in-law, and Fred retired, and Fred didn't have enough to do. Have I told this story in here? No. Fred didn't have enough to do. He was used to going to the office and directing a large program, and so he wandered around the house looking for things to do, as retired men will do, and his wife had been running the household and raising three kids for their entire lives, and she had it together. But he looked for things to manage, and so he finally started managing the coupons in the grocery ads. And she decided this was fairly harmless. You know, money was really not an object for them, but he decided he liked to get the bargains, and they had big storage area for food, so it was okay if he bought a case of maple syrup that they would not use in a lifetime. She would gradually give it away to the kids and other people, and she could manage that. But it came to a head, literally, one day when she had been out and he'd gone grocery shopping, and she came back and, "Hi, you know, what'd you do today?" And he saw, "I ran this wonderful, wonderful bargain on iceberg lettuce." And he said, "It was three for a dollar. Three heads of iceberg lettuce for a dollar." So she sort of did this gasp and, you know, how many heads of iceberg lettuce can you use before it spoils? And so she said, "How many did you buy?" And he said, "Two dozen." And she winced and said, "But there wasn't room in the refrigerator for two dozen." And he said, "No, that's all right. They'll keep. I put them in the freezer." Do some of you have an image of thawing? You know what happens when you freeze iceberg lettuce? It turns into ice, and then when it thaws, mush. Anyway, so you have to be careful about habits, and you have to talk about how you're going to spend the money and who's going to pay for what. It helps to do that. How do you divide the household expenses? What is the fair way to do that? There are several ways to be fair, but you have to pick one that you both agree is fair. So when you decide how you're going to cover the expenses, you have to figure out what they are, And then you have choices. Do you divide them all down the middle? Does each of you put an equal amount in an account? Do you pay them separately? Do you create a joint account? If you're going to create a joint account, a household account, and you both put money in it, do you pool all of your money if you're cohabiting? Usually people only do that if they're certain that they're going to get married. Of course, they won't get married, but they're certain that they will if they're cohabiting, because that's the excuse for cohabiting, that we're going to get married. Or do you pay the household expenses proportionally according to your income? That's also fair. How do you make that decision? Is it 50-50? Is it proportional to income? What if one of you is working full-time and the other is a student on financial aid, just barely covering expenses? How do you do that? If you decide to do it proportionally, based on the resources that you bring in, there is a danger. Anything other than 50-50 runs the risk of having the person who's paying more assume that that translates into more power. Money is power, and unequal incomes and resources can translate into unequal power. So as couples sort out the finances, they have to figure out whether they're going to do it 50-50 and feel that that's perhaps unfair, or do it proportionally and then have to be clear that money and power are separate. Disproportionate money or unequal amounts of money, but proportionate to your ability to pay while maintaining equal power. And there are no easy answers for how to divide things. There's no exactly right way to do it. Where people run into conflict is that they haven't talked about it. And they have brought different assumptions into the microsystem, and they don't even realize what the assumptions are. And then when their assumptions are being violated, then they start, as Mary Beth suggested, you start picking fights that aren't about the actual issue. The actual issue may be about money. The actual issue may be about gender. You're treating me as an inferior because I'm a woman. But I'm not going to fight about that. I'm going to fight about the toilet paper you blow your nose on. May I add that to my repertoire? Okay, thank you. I needed that one. Okay? So money is a problem. Keeping track of money is a huge problem. But that is part of the microsystem pattern. Who keeps track of it? How well do you keep track of it? What do you do when money is needed? How do you make those decisions? All of that, establishing that pattern in the microsystem, is part of creating a couple relationship that will or will not continue. The mesosystem. How's this new setting related to other settings that you're in? Bronfenbrenner is very helpful here, because you've come from home settings, and you're bringing whatever your expectations are from home settings into a new setting. And you may want it to be just like home, or you may want it to be very different from home, but the likelihood is that the two people coming into this setting that they're creating a microsystem in may have different expectations. The likelihood is that they're not going to agree on how to decorate, how to divide the labor, how to establish that pattern, how to resolve the conflicts. What they're doing is establishing a couple relationship that they've not had before, particularly if it's the first time you've cohabited. It's the first time you're playing house for real. And then all of your experience of being in a home where people were playing house, your parents, all of those experiences now can come to the fore. Now we're going to do it the way my mother did. Now we're going to do it the way my father did. And that's why so often people, one of the reasons so often people fall into the traditional, because that's what their parents did. So it helps to have the discussion before you get there about how this is going to be different, and then be vigilant about it. Or comfortable that you do want it to be traditional, but both of you agree that you want that division of labor. But you also then have the relationship of the new setting to the other settings. So what are the issues? Do your parents approve? Can you bring your furniture from your room at home into the new setting? And does your partner want that furniture or not? You probably don't want to bring your bed from home because it was a twin size bed. So, and that won't do. So you get a new bed, right? Waterbed, futon, all of those decisions. But do you bring your dresser? How does the new setting relate? You trying to get my attention? Subtle. Very good. Who has a key to your new apartment? You have a key for your parents. How many of you, when you left home, were asked for your key to your parents' home? Give me the key, right? You were going far away. My son returned his keys, gave them to me when they moved to Albuquerque, because he said, I'm not going to need these anymore. And he's right. So he also knows which rock the spare is under if he shows up in the middle of the night. So he can get in. Most people are not asked to give back their key. Couples have this fun experience of discovering that when they move into an apartment together, one of them has given his or her parents a key to the apartment without asking, without discussion, without talking about it. Do you or do you not give keys to other people? One member of my extended family got into serious difficulty with his wife because he gave his best friend a key to their new apartment when they were cohabiting before they got married. He thought his best friend ought to have a key. I mean, he'd been living with his best friend. His best friend had him keep a key to his apartment. It would be useful. So the partner showed up, and there was the best friend on the couch, drinking beer, watching television. Wait a minute, what is this about? So their first big fight was about who has access, who has a key. Do your parents have to call before they drop in? Can your mother come and clean your new apartment? Can your mother deliver groceries? Can your father come over and hang the door you were complaining about? Can people come in when you're not there? Who has access? Okay. So we'll continue from there, but Julie wants me to give your papers back so she doesn't have to carry them around anymore. So we'll do that.